Let's go ahead and open to Genesis chapter number 4 and continue where we broke off last time, talking about that tragic story of Cain or Cain and Abel or Abel. And the big part of this is that Cain, when he is told that he can no longer be a farmer, that he is going to have to become a gatherer. He's going to have to go out and find food and supplies for himself in the wilderness outside of Eden. He's quite upset. Verse 13 of Genesis 4 says that Cain said to he who is, "My punishment is greater than I can bear. Behold, you've driven me today away from the ground, so I can't be a farmer anymore. And from your face I shall be hidden." And as I've told you a couple of times, I think that's got to do with this idea that the presence of God was right there at the edge of the Garden of Eden. We usually focus on the cherubim down at the bottom, the four-faced, four-winged angels that were guarding the entrance of the Garden of Eden to keep anybody from coming back in again that didn't belong there. But I think they're at the base of that tower of God's presence that we see described in other places in Scripture. But that's probably the focal point of this community that's grown up with Adam and Eve there at the edge of Eden. There's agriculture going on, and there's the herding of some of the animals that they use for sacrifice, and probably trying to have fruit trees and fruit bushes and things of that nature nearby. But now, Cain has to go away from all of that. And so he says, "From your face I shall be hidden." That bothers him a lot, and I'm glad that it does, because that may be indicative of his repentance. But then he talks about something else he's worried about. "I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me." So he's concerned that his siblings and any nieces and nephews that he might have will want vengeance. They will want blood for blood, life for life. But then God's response, I believe, is indicative of the distinction between murder, which is premeditated, and manslaughter, which is accidental. And I believe that the penalty is supposed to be different for those two. And we see that in the Mosaic Code later. And the one that is talked about here is for accidental manslaughter. So he who is said to him, "Not so. If anyone kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold." So in perfection, anyone that takes you out, they're going to be in trouble themselves. And so he who is put a mark on Cain, lest any who found him should attack him. And it was very troublesome in earlier Christian history, especially foolishness going on in the southern part of the United States during the whole atrocity of slavery. That the claim was that the mark of Cain was having black skin. And that is just ridiculous. And it has nothing to do with this story. It should be understood as ridiculous on its face for this one reality. All of the descendants, Cain, died in the flood. There was no one from his line that made it to the other side. So, the real mark, I believe, is the initial mark of leprosy. And when you go to Leviticus chapters 13 and 14, which talks about leprosy, you find out that leprosy is not just some sort of infectious skin disease. It's not Hansen's disease. Hansen's disease is a neurological problem that is part of the curse, if you will, or the fallen state of planet Earth and humanity's health. It can hit people regardless of what their righteous status might be. But the real leprosy mark that we see in those two chapters in Leviticus is placed by God, it's very specific there, placed by God on a person, place, or thing that needs to be evaluated for change. And it's interesting that the evaluation matches exactly the evaluation used in our church discipline standards. You check once and then give it some time. You check a second time, give it some time, and then you check it a third time, and then you take action. And that, I believe, is probably the thing that settles it for me, that the mark of leprosy was all about a sin issue for a person where they needed to change, and God was giving them time and reason to do so. So I believe Cain's mark was probably the first incident of leprosy. Leprosy, as you see it described in the human form, is the loss of color in the skin. And it's not just simply that the skin turns white, although that's how it's described in the language sometimes. The skin loses all the melanin. It becomes almost translucent in a way. No coloring whatsoever. Even the hair that's in that area. And that's why it has to be distinguished between burns and scars and things of that nature. But Cain, having been marked by God as somebody serving a timeout sentence for manslaughter, goes away. Verse 16, Cain went away from the presence of he who is, and he settled in the land of Nod. Nod is just the Hebrew word for wandering, so it matches what's going on in his life. East of Eden. Then verse 17, Cain knew his wife, which is our euphemism for having sexual activity. People always want to ask, well, where'd he get his wife? Where'd she come from? And the answer is, well, she's more than likely a sister on the offside chance, not a sister, maybe a niece. That seems to be the only two options. And then people are, well, that's incest. It wasn't back at this time. The reason we have incest rules is because the gene pool of close relatives in our time is just too shallow and narrow to take a chance. Because all of the bad places in the genetic code, the missing information, the badly passed on information in the gene code, can then strengthen up in those bad areas and cause even more genetic damage. In this period, where we're talking about Cain is the second generation of humanity, and so his offspring are going to be third generation of humanity. The gene pool of humanity was exceptionally deep and exceptionally broad. And so there was very little damage, danger in offspring. And so close marriages, no big deal at all. So Cain knew his wife. She conceived, and she bore Enoch. Now, that's not the Enoch that we'll talk about later, who goes to walk with the Lord. This is the Cain line, Enoch. When he built a city, that's Cain decides to build a city. More than likely, it is a trading post. This is kind of a workaround for the fact that he's a wanderer. He is a gatherer of things. If you can set up an area of convenience with maybe a water supply and places to sleep and safely communicate with other people, people can start trading things back and forth. And of course, the person who sets the trading post up can take a cut, can take a little commission. And so he comes up with the idea of a trading post slash city. And he called the name of the city after the name of his son, Enoch, which that name basically means something along the lines of dedicated or set aside. So probably very early on, Cain's line gets associated with this trading post somewhere a little ways away from the community of Adam and Eve. Verse number 18. Here we start seeing the genealogical lists that are going to start working its way up to the time of the flood. So Cain is second generation. Enoch is third generation. Verse 18, to Enoch was born Irad, so he's fourth generation. And then Irad fathered Mahulyael, so he's number five. Mahulyael fathered Methushael, so he's number six. And Methushael fathered Lamech, and Lamech is the seventh generation from Adam in the Cain line. And there is probably some significant things about that seventh generation, not the least of which is going to be that we no longer have generations one or two around, probably. When I have worked on the genealogical lists that we find here in the book of Genesis, I prefer the dating that comes out of the Alexandrian Greek Septuagint. And one of the reasons that I prefer it to the Masoretic text that most English Bibles are based on in the book of Genesis is that it is the preferred text of the first century church. Also, in a weird twist, the Septuagint text represents an older form of Hebrew text because it was translated from Hebrew in the 3rd century BC. The Masoretic text comes from the medieval period of the New Testament era, the church era. So, weirdly enough, the Septuagint represents an older Hebrew text than the Masoretic text represents. And then, lastly, and by the way, you can see this side by side if you check out my chronological companion to the Bible, which is, there's a link to it in the PDF resources portion of intotheword.net. I have both of these laid out. And the natural progression of births and deaths in generations makes much more sense using the numbers from the Greek Septuagint. In the Masoretic text, you end up with having a whole bunch of births all together, and then a whole bunch of deaths all together, and then another birth, and then a whole bunch of deaths, and then another birth, and then a bunch of deaths. And that's just not, that's not the natural way that generations progress. It's much more likely several generations, then a death, then a birth, maybe another birth, then a death, then a birth, then a death, then a birth, then a death. That's much more natural. And that's what you see in the Septuagint. All right, so Lamech was in the seventh generation, and based on the Alexandrian Septuagint, Adam died during the birth cycle of the fifth generation, and Seth died during the beginning of the seventh generation. So the two generations that had very close connection with God, the first generation having been created by God, the second generation being there in the presence of God at the edge of Eden, they probably moderated the attitudes and the choices of those first six generations. But as we have the old saying, when the cat's away, the mice will play. Well, in this case, when the revered ancestors are dead and buried, sin comes out and goes wild. And so that's exactly what we see in this seventh generation from Adam. Verse 19 of Genesis 4, Lamech took two wives. So this is the first incident recorded of polygamy. The name of the one was Adah, the name of the other, Zillah. Adah bore Yabal. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. And so this is a description of the eighth generation seeming to give rise to Bedouin lifestyle. A Bedouin lifestyle is you do shepherding, but you do it on the move. And as the population of the planet grows, it's going to be more and more necessary to move around farther and farther into the wilderness, away from the initial population area next to the Garden of Eden. And so these guys are shepherding on the move. Now, his brother's name was Yubal. And the only difference between their names is a slight vowel change in that first syllable, which makes me suspect that they're probably twins. Both names mean something similar about water moving along. So his brother's name was Yubal. He was the father of all those who play the lyre and the pipe. And so here we have musicians coming into existence as recorded. Now, Zillah, the other wife of Lamech, also bore Tubal-Cain. Tubal-Cain, as you might guess, is related to the namesake at the beginning of this line. It's the idea, you will be brought forth from Cain or of Cain. So just a reminder that we're in the Cain line here, basically. So he, Tubal-Cain, was the forger of all instruments of bronze and iron. So now we start having metallurgy show up in the eighth generation since creation. And that's a lot of work. You have to dig the iron out. You have to use techniques of high heat to smelt it, that is to turn it into a liquid form where you can get rid of the slag away from the more pure metal and then form it into different shapes. So metallurgy and blacksmithing probably comes into existence here. The eighth generation from Adam. Now, what are we talking about time-wise? Well, we're probably, according to the Alexandrian Septuagint, the Greek Old Testament, we're probably 1,200, 1,300 years into creation itself. Now, the sister of Tubal-Cain was Naamah, and nothing said about her. Now, verse 23, another story about the attitude of a member of this line. And it's not a good attitude. Remember, Cain's attitude was thinking that he could just offer a substandard sacrifice to God and God wouldn't accept it. And then Cain gets mad about it and God warns him that that's going to get him into trouble and it's going to be bad. And it does. It ends up with the whole manslaughter thing. Well, here is his ancestor, Verse 23, Lamech said to his wives, Ada, Zillah, hear my voice, you wives of Lamech. Listen to what I say. I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for striking me. So we have another death story, don't we? But this guy is saying, not that I killed somebody that was trying to kill me, or I executed someone that hurt someone else or executed someone else. He's basically saying somebody hurt me and I got even by killing him. Verse number 24, if Cain's revenge is sevenfold, remember that, then Lamech's is 77-fold. So he's basically bragging, if anyone tries to do anything about what I did, I'm going to get him even harder. So this is representative of a very bad attitude that starts, I think, being prevalent during this seventh and eighth generation from the time of creation itself. And I'm going to tie it in to some other things that start going south or sideways or pear-shaped or whatever idiom you want to use during this same approximate period. So that's the first seven generations through Cain. Now we revert back. We go back to when the death of Abel took place. Verse 25. Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son and called his name Set. Now, Set is Hebrew for payback or compensation. And so it is clear from what she says here that Set is the first boy born to Adam and Eve after the death of Abel. So she said, God has appointed for me or paid me back with another offspring instead of Abel, for Cain killed him. And so this is going to help us understand that the Cain-Abel story took place more than likely the year before the birth of Seth. So keep that in your mind. Now, to Seth, also a son was born, and he called his name Enosh. Now, Enosh is Hebrew for just a man. At that time, people began to call upon the name of He Who Is. Now, let me share with you what I think that means. Seth is a second tier within the second generation of mankind since eternity. Now, because everybody is living on average, and we'll find this out later, into their 900s, it would seem as if we've got at least 400 years worth of having of babies with each of these couples. So it's hard to pin down a generation when you've got several centuries worth of offspring being born. So each generation gets bigger and bigger. And if you had a calculator, it's not going to take you long to figure out that the first generation is only two, but the second generation has got to be several hundreds. And then they all pair off. The third generation is going to be many tens of thousands. By the time you get to your fourth generation, you're going to end up with millions. And it's just going to keep getting more and more. Even though you start having people die off, it's not going to be significant enough to change the growing curve of population. So the third generation, as already said, is probably made up of tens of thousands of people. You can't have tens of thousands of people living an agricultural shepherding sort of lifestyle all jammed together in a small location. They're going to have to spread around. And that means, folks, that some people are going to voluntarily move away from the presence of He who is, away from His face. This gets back to my my belief that God's visible presence was right there at the border between Adam and Eve's original home and the Garden of Eden that was off limits. So people are going to be far enough away that they can't do a daily visitation with God, with His presence, because I think they also did worship there. So what will they do instead? They will set up a worship site where they live, which is probably going to consist of an altar where they offer sacrifices for sin and sacrifices for thanksgiving and appreciation. And the father of the household, maybe the leader of the community that might grow up around that altar, is going to be kind of the priest figure. Now, why do I believe that that's the likely thing? Because as we go farther and farther into the book of Genesis, we're going to see this phrase that so-and-so set up an altar and called upon the name of the Lord. So I think those two things go together. So I believe at the end of chapter number 4, we're seeing the beginning of worship at a distance where the people are living.